All right. Good afternoon. I'll say it again. Good afternoon. Come on, it's Tuesday. We're just getting started. We have two more days left. Good point. My name is Alfred Ojukwu. I'm here to present 7410 and 7417. The exam prep for installing and configuring Windows Server 2012. This will get you your MCSA. Now, real quick show of hands, how many people came to the session yesterday? Did you come to the whole thing? Ah, that's right. Okay, so a lot of good content. The really cool part is I get an extra 10 to 15 minutes because my buddy, David, won't be here. The bad news for that is that if you don't understand the exam preparation taking concepts like how to choose questions, the type of questions, you might want to go back and watch the old 7410 session that was delivered yesterday or any one of the other sessions that are being delivered, because the first 15 minutes, he pretty much covers that. So before we get going, I want everyone to stand up. Look, he's upset. He's like, I don't want to stand up. Yeah. This isn't the last session, but I want you guys to kind of relax, right? Shake your shoulders out. Okay, what I want you to think about is you're going into that exam room. You want to be relaxed. You want to have a good time. This is not the GREs. This isn't the LSAT. Have fun, right? All right, go ahead and sit down. How many people have taken at least one exam while they're here? Two. Dang. Okay, that's okay. Great. I'm going to stress it, and I'll stress it again. Everybody here, take the advantage and get at least one exam done while you're here. It's your preference. It's your opportunity to kind of be at will to kind of make sure you get a certification for at least one exam. And I would make the suggestion that you don't necessarily go off to your manager and say, hey, I'm going to take the exam. Take the exam first, make sure you do well on it, and then say, hey, guess what? I passed the exam. All right? You guys already know that. So, again, this is going to cover Windows Server 2012 and also the R2 changes. So I'm going to talk about some of the R2 changes, some of those questions that you might have, and hopefully when we get done, I'll be able to provide you some of these slides, and you'll be able to use them as you're preparing for exam. Now, when we get closer to the end, I'll show you some free resources that we have available, as well as some books. You guys already know about the booth that's over here in the Expo Center, where we have our Microsoft Learning that's available for you. Okay, So a little bit about me. Even though I have a purple shirt, I actually work for Microsoft. I'm out of New York. I work with MCS as a consulting services, work with large financial customers, both commercial and some PubSec, delivering solutions like Windows Intune and Configuration Manager and managing their desktop clients. Consequently, I'll also be covering 7415 and 7416 tomorrow afternoon at 1:30, which goes into the client management piece. Hopefully some of you guys might be interested in that as well. But of course, you still need servers. So I have about 19 years of background of just managing servers through Active Directory, Exchange, and just basic server infrastructure management. So that's one of my favorite things to do. I'm involved with a lot of internal and external communities, mostly internal. A lot of people internally know me because I drive a program called Exam Connect Jeopardy, basically a game show where we do internally. We talk about different concepts that come up around exams, exam questions, and literally we just, whoever wins. There's three or four winners every week. As a matter of fact, as soon as I'm done with the session, I have one in about 2 hours. To 10. Sorry, had to share that with you guys. Okay, really quick link, thedevicepros.com, if you want to find information about technologies that we're talking about. My buddy Frank Pinto and I, we run that, and you'll be able to find information there, as well as the device pros, the Facebook, the device pro professionals as well. And I ask this every single time, how many people are a member of the crew? Come on, raise your hands up high. The crew. Ah, come on, guess. No, good. Just want to say, everybody else, I'm glad you're here, as well as you guys are from the crew. He's like, I don't get it. No, that's cool. So if you're interested, make sure you're a member of the crew. Here's the exam objectives. We're going to go over, well, we're not going to go over the certification overview. That's basically preparing for exams, knowing what you need to do. What we're going to jump into is the exam preparation sections. And this is a different question. How many people are actually thinking about taking the 7410 exam? And I hope everybody's hand goes up. He's like, I don't need it. I know this stuff. This is great. No, that's cool. So we'll describe the exam objectives as it pertains to 7410. A lot of the material will pertain to also 7417. And the important thing to remember here is that even though if you're doing an upgrade exam from Windows Server 2008 and any of those other MCS, MCITP exams, you'll only have to take the 7417 in order to get, and you'll have to take the 7417 to be able to get your upgraded license to an MCSA, and then you have to take at least two other tests to get your MCSC. Again, if you listen to other sessions, you'll probably see some of that information. Our goal today is to identify areas that you may require to, you know, brushing up on, so you can be prepared for the exam and you can actually walk in and walk out and do well in it. So I am going to actually jump ahead here. Give me 2 seconds because David is not here. We are going to cut out a number of the sections and go straight into the exam conversation. All right. And make sure your phones are off as we go through. Now, so 7410, 7417. The goal of the exam are, as listed above, we're going to start off by talking about installing and configuring servers, what's required there, in configuring server roles and features. Now, I won't read the rest of the list here, but the point that I think this slide kind of makes is it's weighted equally. Each section is weighted equally. And for those of you guys who have taken exams in the past, you know that there's just a number of different questions that you might get asked. But at the end of the day, if you get 60 to 80 questions, each one of them will be testing your strength in each one of these areas. So it's very important that you make sure that you're strong in each area and you understand the type of questions that they're going to ask. Another key thing to remember is that it's been trickled in with R2 flavor and the information around R2, some of the changes. And as we go through each section in this presentation, I will share with you some of those changes in terms of what's been added and changed since January 2014. If you, I'm seeing that there's only a couple of you that probably have taken, has anyone actually completed 7410? Well, okay, so was it? Well, okay, so you did it when it first came out. So, the exam that he took, it will have a lot of similar flavors, but you'll see that these exams will have a little bit more of the newer features because they've updated with R2 information as well. Again, we'll cover core network services, installing, administering Active Directory, and lastly, creating and managing group policies. The install and configuring servers covers just the basic concepts. Again, this isn't the 410 is the first of three series of tests, the 7410, 7411, and 7412. It's really testing you on knowing what you need to do with server installations and understanding when and how to configure the server so that you can maximize it on your desk, in your infrastructure, the type of disk that you're going to use, and whether you need to be able to manage it remotely as requires. Well, and we'll talk about what those things are as we go into the slides. First thing to remember, there are four different versions, and we have Data Center, Standard, Essentials, and Foundation. Now, many of you guys probably work with Data Center and Standard. How many people work with Essentials or Foundations? Anybody? Again, so here's the important thing. If you're familiar with what Data Center and Standards are, you probably need to spend a little bit more time just understanding what foundations provide and what essentials also provide. Because in those two different servers, there's a little bit less functionality. And as you're going through the test and they're asking you questions about what type of servers am I going to be using, you need to understand what those limitations are. For example, the foundation server probably supports, only 15 users, whereas the essential server probably supports 25 users. Again, depending on what your role is, and we'll go into a slide that shows some of that as well. Understand the differences in licensing. Basically, how do I license the server? And in this list, you see the options between POS instances and VOS instances. Anybody know the difference, what a POS or VOS is? You're not allowed to answer. I'm kidding. Yeah, physical, virtual, right. Knowing how you would actually license your servers. And essentials, again, you have only one option. Either you're going to have a physical instance or a virtual instance, right? You can't have both because of the licensing. Now, technically, you can actually do both. But in terms of the exam and what's being tested, they want to understand if you understand what the licensing model is. Same thing with foundations. You can only have it as a physical operating system running on a physical box. Then we talk about the virtual instances of standard, having a total of two different virtual instances in terms of licensing. And then when you get up to data center, there really is no limit on the number of virtual machines. And that's where I think the maximization of the data center and just the operating system on Windows Server 2012 sort of takes on the light. Now, can anybody name any other types of servers that are related to Windows Server 2012? Hyper-V, Server 2012, that's another one. Anybody else know of any others? Server Core is not in a version, but very close. Good concept. Go ahead. Enterprise is that. So you got to be careful when you get in the exam room. Watch out for Enterprise is gone, exactly. Storage servers, so I heard Hyper-V, storage, and there's one more. So, no, web, again, that's gone too, so good thing we're getting this out of the way. So I'll just share it out here, multipoint servers. So multipoint servers still exist, right? Basically using it to manage a single point where users can actually connect to. You have storage servers 2012 and the Hyper-V server, which just runs the Hyper-V role. Now, again, you will only be tested on those four, data center, standard, foundations, and essentials. But it's just something that you want to understand that you have that option to run Server 2012 on these other systems, that they're still available, and that you can actually upgrade your existing servers from that certain level to the next level. From 2008 to 2012. Okay? So real quick, in comparison, we start talking about three different types of comparisons, right? Because standard and data center are essentially made up of the same stuff, right? It's just a matter of what do I select when I'm doing my install process. So with the processor limit, you start seeing that standard can have up to 64 processors, and essentials is limited to 2. And foundations is limited to 1. You start seeing that the RAM, again, is up to 4 terabytes, which is definitely something you want to see with standard data center, all the way down to when we start thinking about Active Directory services, what sort of limitations do I have based on my server versioning? And if you're in the exam and you're being asked questions of what am I going to run and why am I going to run it, know that you're going to be limited if you select the foundations and essentials. For example, with Active Directory services, if you need to run the only thing you could typically do is run a certificate authority only on one of those foundations and essentials. And usually that's because you're in a migration state. You're not typically going to use it to manage your Active Directory certificate services. One of the main reasons is you won't be able to run the web enrollment through one of the foundation or essential servers. So a number of other reasons why you would think about using the standard data centers, for example, the file server limits, and having just one DFS route per foundations or essentials. Again, just limitations to be aware of as you're going through. I mentioned the max users and the remote routing and remote access limitations as well. Now, as you bring up your system, quick question, what is the default installation that you get when you start a Windows Server 2012 installation? Standard core. And any reason, do you understand? And so standard core is the actual default configuration. And one of the main reasons is just they want to keep that light. They want to keep it with the hardware resource optimization available and making sure there's just the basic reduction of disk space. Again, Server Core, again, is a very light version of Windows Server 2012. It removes all of the additional features, but it gives you the ability to do other things in terms of, you know, specifying a specific role that you want that server to be run as. And it also does reduce the attack surface as well. So by default, it starts out with the Server Core installation. You can switch it. If you run it to some, if you actually want to manage it, you can actually do it through a command line and have the installation install through using the GUI that you're looking for. So that's the default GUI you'll see. From there, once you have your server up and running, you then need to decide what you need to understand what the installation requirements are. Now, Microsoft has kept it simple. We want to make sure that Windows Server 2012 is running on a number of different servers, and with that being the case, the limit isn't necessarily at the lowest it could possibly be, but it's low enough where you can have 1.4 gigahertz processor, you can have 512 RAM, and you can have up to 32 gigs of available space. Now, you know, I'm pretty sure many of you probably aren't running servers at that level, but these are just some of the requirements that you'll probably see with installing the install requirements. Key things to note here, and you know, I don't think, if we remember right, with Server 2008, some of those others, we don't really talk about internet access. You know, you need that as part of your install process. You're going to be just tested on understanding what those key requirements are. So all of these are just basically minimal requirements. Now, if you get that question, think about the minimums. Don't think about necessarily what I'm going to do in a real office, right? If in my real data center, I'm not going to run the minimums. I'm going to run it based on what I need to have available on the systems. Another. Is somebody calling us? Just guess. So, what did Cortana say? Ask Cortana. Oh, is that Siri? Oh, come on. Oh, yeah, it is. I'm sorry, what do you need internet access for? So you would need internet access. So again, it's not one of the key requirements, but in other words, to get the key actually to take place, the key to actually register, you need that internet access. So a lot of times we end up, when we're doing the labs, we skip that internet access. And it's just one of those basic requirements. It's not, you know, if you don't have it, you can't install it, because again, I install Windows Server 2012 without internet access in my labs all the time. So yeah, it's more around activation, but again, that doesn't prevent you from installing. Again, minimum requirements, I get it. This is what you're going to see on the test. Think about it. Don't sweat it. Just know that it might be an option. I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing. I get it. All right. So we mentioned this earlier before, the number of failover clusters that are supported. We start seeing that. And as well as the supported maximums. In other words, what's my limitation of Server 2012, and what can I do with it in terms of RAM? And we start seeing the comparison between Server 2008 and R2. Just know the differences, because those are the decisions you're going to have to make when you're looking to select an answer on the exam itself. Now, with Server Core, some of the features on demand, some of the features that you get are things like features on demand, the ability to install or uninstall features as needed. In other words, the roles are pretty much basically made so that you can decide what you want to have on it, and you can control what features are managed on that system. And that information is typically located in C Windows SXX directory. Basically, all that information around what files are going to be installed. I know many of you probably are server admins or infrastructure admins. Typically, what we tend to do is we copy it off to a server, and we can actually run our commands and pull those files across the network and install those features as needed, or have it on a CD or DVD drive where we can actually pull those, call that directory and use that to install the features that we're looking for. The idea is that you're going to reduce storage space, and you can actually do this offline, and you do it on VHDs and VHDXs. A good example of what that command line looks like is just basically that. Now, I didn't post that just to say, hey, look at that. I really think about what those commands are, because again, and you'll hear this quite a bit with a lot of the exams, PowerShell is key. Know your PowerShell scripts. Know your PowerShell commands, understand what they're trying to say, and how to just basically read it. It should not, you know, at this point, I think PowerShell has been around for a while. If you're not, you know, actively working with it or even thinking about what it needs to do, you probably need to break it open and just click on get help. So very, very important to understand. This is just a simple command that talks about being able to install a feature in a Wim, on a source Wim itself, and then it automatically has that available when that image is actually installed in that system. So server core, again, is another piece that gets brought up quite a bit. Understanding what you can do with server core, the difference between installing server core. Now, how many people actually run systems with server core in their infrastructure? Right. What are the main reasons why you run server core?
Offline root for CA.
Okay. Say some system resource, just, you know, reduces the attack surface. So all those reasons are things. So with the case studies, and again, with 7410, you don't see a whole lot of case studies. But if you get them, think about when and why you would have server core running. And what we see is that the number of roles that are available have gone up from 12 to 19. However, the roles that are not available are the things that you also want to think about, like volume activation services and remote desktop services. I can't have server core if I have if I have a request or a need to have any of these services listed here. Network policy and access services. So what I would typically want to do is, you can do it one or two ways. If you realize you have a server core system and you need to run one of these roles, you're going to have to install the Windows feature using the add feature functionality. And again, this is just another example of how I'd actually go about removing the core version. So some people, sometimes what they'll do is they'll install the full Windows Server 2012 with the core, and then afterwards remove the GUI itself. And that way, you'll be able to minimize the attack surface. You already have it all configured the way you want it to, and you can basically let that server do what it needs to do without having the exposed attack surface. Another thing to keep in mind is sconfig still matters. How many people know what sconfig is? Yeah, so you're still going to be able to administer your servers using sconfig. And it's just, you can basically manage the servers, but you have to be a member of the administrative group, which is one of those requirements that allow it to work the way it needs to. And again, if you're in the exam room and you're being asked questions around sconfig, it's still a valuable solution. Just think through what you're being asked. You can do it 50 times if you want to, right? It's not a, you know, either or. Yeah, exactly. But I wouldn't recommend it, though. No, good question. Okay, let's keep going. So deploying images, so deploying server images. Now, again, I am a client guy. So DISM is the tool that I use a lot with building images using tools like MDT. And maybe some of you guys know about MDT, yes? Yeah, so, you know, typically when we talk about deploying images, we're talking about MDT. However, in this specific exam, DISM is what matters. DISM basically gives you the ability to control what you add, the type of features you add, what type of features you enable on the system, managing the system offline. Know DISM, right? Know the other tools that are like DISM. For example, ImageX, which is a deprecated functionality that is no longer, that still works, but we wouldn't necessarily want to use that as our option when we're, you know, adding images. And I just put a couple of the command lines that I think are, you know, of interest. Again, same way you're adding features to an image, those commands are available for you to use. Okay, and other thing to consider is just post-installation tasks, things that you would want to think about having on your system. For example, configuring the network, setting the time zone, enabling remote desktop. In other words, they might ask you a question of, you finally installed the system and you have everything going the way you want to, what else should you do? Here are just a few of the other tasks that you typically do. As an admin, you guys probably already know this. This is by default. You know, once you build that system and it has that long, funky name, you're going to want to change it, you know. You really don't want it to be, you know, because not that it
should matter because of remote service, you know, remote management, but you typically want to change it so it matches your infrastructure. And of course, joining the domain and the process in doing so as well. Okay, and as you continue going, you know, again, much of this work is going to be done in Server Manager. Server Manager is where you control the things like NIC teaming, how I would actually go about putting together NIC teaming. And in this type of question, things to remember are the fact that you have three different modes in Server 2012, right? Two different types of NIC teaming, but three different modes. So you have switch independent mode, basically where you have all the network's adapters are connected to different switches providing alternative routes through the network. You know, they basically have their own way to get there and do what they need to do. And unless you're going to use virtual machines, you need to use that Hyper-V port or the dynamic dynamic port, which I'll talk about in a second. So switch independent mode is basically the idea that you'd have that virtual NIC that's available, and basically the NICs converge and decide which route they want to take. Static teaming, or LACP, Link Aggregated Control Protocol, basically requires some level of hardware. It requires some level of support, and really goes back to the 802, 802.3 AD, 802.1 AX requirements. It basically, like for LACP, it'll basically identify or dynamically identify the links between the NICs and basically add and remove NICs as needed to your actual teaming process. And it controls the number of NICs that are available. So when you're faced with that option, kind of think about it. So here's a quick drop down of what that looks like. You have your NICs, you have your options in terms of teaming modes. What am I going to do? You know, typically when you're building servers, you're working in labs, you're typically going to choose a switch independent mode. And you notice it doesn't say switch dependent. It actually has static teaming or LACP. Again, the static teaming LACP may be used if you know that you have hardware and you want to force that hardware to actually use that option. The next phase of that is the understanding the options around how I would actually do the balancing. So you have the address hashing, basically being able to divide the traffic by IP address or ports or whatever, you know, whatever you want to actually manage the balance. Balance the traffic with. And you also have the option of using the Hyper-V port, basically having it funneled through the VM that you're actually running and deciding which VM, allowing it to decide which VM that traffic needs to go to. So you may want to have that as a configuration option. One other option that's not on here is the dynamic, load balancing mode, which is dynamic. Again, this is an image of 2012, not R2. And this includes features of the other two balancing modes. It can move network streams between network cards. And that's available in Windows Server 2012 R2. Just something to keep in mind and as you're building your networks, your NIC cards. And PowerShell, PowerShell, PowerShell. If you're not sure, just go to Get Help. Do a quick Get Help. Know the command. Pull up the commands. Look at them. Understand what they're trying to do and understand what they actually mean. Because what you'll be given is a list of different PowerShell commands. You'll see that more in 7411, but it's still relevant in 7410. A good example is this command here, where you have new netlbfo team, and again, net load balancing failover team, and you basically take the new team, add NIC1 and NIC2 together, put it in teaming mode, which is a link aggregated control protocol, and then set up the balancing algorithm to the Hyper-V ports. In other words, knowing which ports it wants to go through. So being able to read what the PowerShell command is doing and just understanding what you're trying to achieve by the question also becomes very important. When you're looking at the console and server manager, you should see that teaming is enabled. By default, it will typically be disabled, but this is just a view of what you'd actually see. The next piece, Windows disk settings, right? So now we're getting into, I've got my server up and running, I've figured out what network it needs to be on, I've configured my NIC cards, it's talking to the servers that I care about, but what are my disks doing? How are my disks performing? How am I ensuring that they can do what they need to do? So you have options to select from when you're taking the exam. You have your options around, what do I choose, MBR or GPT disk? So two different types of disk. MBR, as you probably already know, was the older format of disk, which had up to 3 partitions and 1 extended partitions. And it was basically limited to 2 terabytes. You know, it's been around for a while, and for many of you, I'm sure many of you guys who's working with UEFI right now, and many of you should probably already be working with UEFI, and there's, you know, you start seeing that requirement of having a GPT disk or using disks that have that level of expansion to be above 2 terabytes, because you have disks now that are coming in that are 3 terabytes and plus that size coming into the organization. So you have to be able to manage that. So the GPT disks support 128 partitions. So you can have up to 128 partitions. And part of the reason is because the way the partitions work is that they're set up using GUIDs, right? And it basically blows away what you can do with MBR. Now, I'm not saying you won't use them, but just know when you want to think about using the GUID partition and the fact that now you have that flexibility to have additional partitions in there. In MBR, when you're dealing with basic disks have partitions. And I think this is a somewhat of a fundamental mistake. We always call them partitions, regardless of whether basic disks or dynamic disks. In dynamic disks, they're actually volumes. So you're creating a number of different volumes. You're managing those volumes separately. And those volumes are synonymous to the fact that you have a number of different disks that you can actually, you know, give it a different drive letter, and you can have actually have unlimited number of partitions, but the disk limit is usually 128, and that's what you end up with. Then you want to also think about how do I divide my disk in partitions? So, you know, am I doing a simple or spanned or striped or mirrored or RAID configuration? What is it that I'm doing with my disk? Now, you'll see in this exam we start talking about storage spaces and storage tiering. This concept gets built right into it, but still understand how you would do it in a standalone disk. You know, if I had my disk, how do I decide what type of disk I'm going to create in what scenario? Again, I'm not going to go over RAID 1 through RAID 5. These are things that you probably have, if you've already taken your NT exams, you probably know them somewhat well. And then one other thing that I want to mention is the format partition. I have NTFS, FAT32, FAT16. Can anybody name any others? REFS, right, REFS. And that really is, to me, it's somewhat new, and it's a new file system appearing in 2012, and it offers the unlimited directory size. It can pretty much be big, but it basically is sort of error. It's error resilient. It gets rid of the need for error checking. You no longer have to worry about error checking with REFS. So, again, the key, again, as you're going in the exam, you'll see all of these options. Know what they mean. Know what the limitations are. FAT32, you can only works in the 32-bit system. NTFS is usually the default that you want to think about, because most of the time that's what we're using. It's what drives our file share permissions. It's what that ensures that we're actually building the system. And most of the disks that we use are compatible with NTFS. Most of the operating systems and the files that we're using work with EFS. A couple things to remember about REFS is that it doesn't support features such as file compression or encryption. Again, and disk quotas as well. So things to think about REFS. If you get questions around that, remember that REFS has those limitations, and you may not be able to do those things. And lastly, REFS is supported on Windows Server 2012 and Windows 8. You won't be able to run REFS on any older operating systems. Working with disk. So again, I won't go too far into detail. You can create and mount VHDs. You know the difference between VHDs and VHDXs. VHDXs now have the XML format. They take on the concept of the GPT disk, as we mentioned earlier, and they don't have the limitation in terms of size. They can really grow to what you want. So there are tools out there that allow you to migrate or convert your VHDs to VHDXs. However, one of the things that they were, you know, you kind of sort of got used to is if you're going to move your systems from VHDs to VHDXs, you have to either recreate them new or build it and migrate your data over to that new VHDX. But there are tools that will convert it to VHDXs. But you won't be tested on that directly. Just know that there are differences between the two. Again, take advantage of the server manager usage for disk management. You start seeing where we have storage spaces and how storage spaces work. For just a basic understanding of how storage pools work and what you want to think about when you're dealing with storage pools basically allow you to create different pools of disks that you can then manage and carve out to the operating system to be used as virtual volumes, right? So typically what you're going to do in this scenario is you're going to create your storage pools, right? You create your storage pools, then you add the disk to them. You actually add the disk, and with tiering, you can actually say, I want a storage pool that's made up of SSDs, a storage pool that's made up of HDs, just a regular disk. And then from there, once I have those disks added to them, I can actually decide how I want to carve out the volumes and present it to the actual operating system and decide how I want to carve out the volumes. The benefit of storage pools and using that as an option is the fact that you can actually add disk at a later time, and it will figure out how that disk will be used on that system itself. So with the exam, and this is another one of the new features, make sure you're kind of getting familiar with what storage pools are. Anybody attended any sessions that talks about storage spaces at all? Yeah, so good content, right? I'm sure you got a chance to sit through it. It's definitely worth the read. It's definitely worth the exploration. It looks somewhat difficult, but when it gets right down to it, it's really the idea. It's one of those pieces that a lot of people have been waiting to see virtualized, right? Now you have the ability to just manage your disk virtually and decide what you want to present to the actual operating system, okay? And then just creating simple volumes, how you'd actually do that, how you can actually remove, you know, expand your disk, and how you can actually shrink your disk as needed. You still have that option available. So, tips to remember in this first section. 64-bit only, we mentioned that already. Version edition differences, knowing the difference between standard essential foundations and data center. Things not in core. I think we showed that earlier. And then disk partition types. What are my disk partition types? When and how to configure NIC teaming. And lastly, DISM. Right? These are just key tips you want to think about as you're going into the exam. Okay. Test exam questions. So hopefully none of you guys have been to the last session, so you guys don't know the answer yet. But we'll see if you guys can figure it out. I'll read it for you. Which of the following are valid reasons why administrators might want to install their Windows Server 2012 servers using the core options? How many people think it's A? Raise your hand up. How many people think it's B? How many people think it's C? How many people think it's D? How many people think it's all of them? Now this is, yeah, so the really cool part, choose all that apply, right? So if we choose all that apply, right? Yes, A is correct. So server core installation can be converted to full GUI without reinstalling the operating system. B, PowerShell 3.0 interface in Windows Server 2012 includes more than 10 times as many command lines as PowerShell 2.0, right? We know that because it's an upgrade. It's the next version. And new server manager in Windows Server 2012 makes it far easier to administer servers remotely as opposed to what we saw in 2008. Again, another key thing to think about when you take an exam. Now, this one's questionable because I heard somebody say, what's a version of Windows Server 2012? And didn't somebody over here say core? Is core a version of Server 20? Absolutely not. You're absolutely right. Exactly. So don't think of core as a version. It's just it's a type of feature that you actually have on the operating system. Those are your answers. That's a typical type of question that you'll probably get on the exam. We'll have a few more coming up a little bit later. Let's move on with the next section. I'll go a little bit faster because I have a lot more content to cover. Configure server roles and features. So this covers things like configuring access-based enumeration, volume shadow copy services, migrations, and going into file and print services. So you still get questions around how do I manage my print drivers, how do I manage my print servers and ensure that people have access to network printers and can actually configure it that way. And then lastly, configuring servers for remote management, which Server Manager gives you the ability to do that just by adding the server there. Okay, so configuring file shares and NTFS permissions. So just some key things to think about. It should say configuring file shares and NTFS permissions. But key thing to remember, think about is what am I trying to do, right? There's the option to do your security permissions and to do your file shares, right? If I'm trying to do it on a file share, then you're going to think about sharing it on the network only, because that's what the goal is. I want someone to be able to access that file across the network somewhere else. It's always your first line of defense when you actually throw in permissioning on top of it and have that file share available based on the specific role. You see that you end up with different options from read, change, full, and full control, the basic options. And then as you get into the basic and advanced permissions, there's a whole lot more when you're dealing with security file, the security of the actual folder or file that you're looking to share. You need both of those to be able to actually share the folders correctly on the network and on the local PC itself. The question comes up, how would I want to share my folders? Am I going to do it on the folders only, or am I going to do it on the drive? Now, typically, you don't want to do it on the drive. You can do it on the drive, but you don't want to do it on the drive. You probably want to do it on the folder itself. So again, think about that question, and when you're being asked questions around, what am I doing with my folders, and how am I actually administering it? How do I actually go about making sure that it works the way I want it to? And you're going to deal with it at the folder level. Also think about what the effective permissions are. If you add up a number of roles that a specific user has, what is the effective permissions? And you have that option now that's available for you to see when you're configuring your servers. And like I said, deny always wins. If there's a deny rule in any point in time, that deny will prevent that user from accessing. It'll overwrite any other requirement that says you have access to this file. That denial will win. I think many of you guys probably are aware of that. Just something to think about. And you're going to combine it with NTFS permissions. Your file shares will always be combined with NTFS permissions just to have it at higher level security. And another cool thing that comes up outside of administrative shares, which gives you the access to $C$, which a lot of that's been sort of locked down through the security requirements on the newer operating systems, you have configuring access-based enumeration. Anybody know what access-based enumeration, Abe, is? Yeah, again, I know you got it. You just took the test. You're good. I know. So Abe really is one of another cool features. Now, funny enough, it's been around since Server 2003. It's not a new feature. It's just that now it's becoming a little bit more pronounced. It's becoming something that really helps you manage who has access to files of that nature. So if you're being asked questions around a profile redirection, a folder redirection, Abe becomes something you can think about because you can prevent users from seeing files that that you don't want them to see. Or if you're dealing with DFS shares, right, distributed file shares in your infrastructure, if you have Abe enabled, you'll prevent them from actually seeing files that they don't have access to. It's a very controlled way of managing who has access to files on the actual network itself. And you can also allow caching of shares, so it basically enables offline users to access the content of the server when those are offline. So this kind of shows you a quick GUI of what that looks like when you're setting up your shares and what options you have available. Okay. Additional file share features, which continue on, you can have the option to configure them offline. Offline features also come up as well. Basically, again, this isn't a trivia. We know that offline files allow you to have access to your files when you're not on the network. Almost known as client-side caching, you can actually control those through group policy and control who has access to the files or who can actually use them and have backups of that information. It's really good for people that are taking their desktops out of the office and need access to them offline, and a very good sync mechanism because as soon as you come back online, that data syncs right back up as needed. Also think about disk quotas. How do I set disk quotas? How do I ensure that I'm limiting the disk usage In other words, from a maximum to a minimum, making sure that I either have a soft or a hard configuration. When they get the user gets to 100 gigs or 100 gigs, you know, give them a warning. But when they get to 120, basically prevent them from doing what they need to do. Knowing how to set your file permissions also become important, and using it in file server resource monitoring, making sure you know who's actually using what aspect of the files. Also know that you can create templates. Now, again, I won't go into all the details about disk quotas, but this is a big piece of the exam as well. It's going to test you in that section, making sure you understand what that is. And then lastly, volume shadow services, a volume shadow copy. It's a feature that enables you to maintain previous versions of the file on the server so that if a user accidentally deletes or overwrites a file, they can access the copy, and you can only implement shadow copies for an entire volume. And you can specify specific file shares or files. So just another piece of information to know. This kind of shows you a quick screenshot of what that looks like, and having that enabled on your the volume as well. So the volume shadow copy is very important. You can go back and just be careful, because when you're going back to that snapshot and you're doing that recovery, you might want to make sure that you have that data that you're looking for, so you don't have to go back and sort of fish through to find it. A new feature in Windows Server 2012 R2 that gets covered in the exam now is work folders. Work folders is very similar to what many of you guys know, what we all know as OneDrive, and works similar to offline folders, but much more advanced. It has policies built into it, enables administrators to provide users with synchronized access to their files on multiple workstations and devices while storing them on a network file server. Right? So the principle is roughly the same. Like I mentioned, and here are some concepts to think about. What do I need to have a file? What do I need to have to make sure work folders are working? You'd have to basically install the work folder role on the system and basically have it as a file and storage service in the back end. And basically, you can have multiple sync shares per server in the back end. This is just a basic back end configuration, and it will allow your file to stay in synchronization on the front end. So it talks through SMB, it can work directly with the server or the file, and once you can have multiple devices connected into it so that when you go from one device to another, you still see the same data across the network. It also works at EFS. You can actually encrypt the data so that the data can't actually be removed, or it can be protected as needed so that people can't do certain things with that information. Here's a quick high-level architecture of what work folders infrastructure would look like, how you would configure it. This sort of scenario would come in when you're having to think through one of those testlets that walk you through, here's my organization, here's what I have configured, what do I need to think about, what do I need to put in place? We talk about data management, making sure we have quotas to prevent users from using too much space, file screens so that they can't actually install things like WMVs or files that aren't necessarily allowed in the infrastructure, knowing what those are. Classifications, HBI, LBI, MBI. So these are high business impact, medium business impact, low business impact. When you're setting up work folders, these are things you want to think about. How do I want to prevent users? How do I want to manage what users can access? And how do I protect my corporate data? So work folders are something that you want to know for this exam and why they exist. So you get questions around what options you're going to use to configure the file shares. You might get a question around DFS and/or work folders. Think about what the goal is with what DFS provides, right? DFS provides replication across multiple locations of distributed file shares where data is available for the end user, but it doesn't necessarily give you access outside of the internal network. And then you start seeing the differences between what you can and can't do and what decisions you need to make when you're taking the exam. Another piece that gets covered is in configuring print, and document servers. I can tell you this piece, it's just around print device management, print server management, print drivers, right? For me to go into detail about print drivers, this is the piece that how many people manage printers as their day-to-day work, right? Understanding what's required around printers, making sure you understand, you know, what you need to configure to ensure that the printers are working, and having your print and file servers identified in your infrastructure. They will ask you questions about that. They'll ask you questions around deploying printers via GPOs. Remember the types of questions that show up. You'll need to be able to select the options. Maybe it's a GPO option. Maybe it's a number of settings that need to be turned on. But understand when prints, how to manage local printers or remote printers. The fact you can configure remote printers is needed as well. And consider things like remote desktop print as needed to servers. Okay, for this section, key tips to remember. Volume shadow services applies to the entire volume. Understand the differences between basic and advanced permissions. Remote management is deeply encouraged. It's already part of the infrastructure. We already realize that. And again, don't forget about quotas. Just another piece to remember, keep in mind. We mentioned storage pools, but again, that goes back to the previous section. And just one thing that I failed to mention before, things like cloning a DFS database, distributed file servers, are still relevant. We didn't talk about DFS here too much. Recovering a DFS database, they're covered. How do I go about recovering DFS database and optimizing DFS replication? How do I ensure that I'm replicating the information in a much more optimized way throughout my infrastructure? And lastly, configuring file management tasks. In other words, I want to be able to manage a server. I can actually put in PowerShell commands to manage clean up the server if there's certain files that don't need to be there after a certain number of dates or being placed in a specific location, and you can have it run nightly. So that gets added to the exam in terms of testing, and that's part of the R2 flavor that's been added. Okay, next set of questions. You guys ready for this one? You don't have a choice. All right, remember I made you guys yawn at the very beginning? Stand up. Hopefully you guys take a deep breath. All right, let's keep going. You create a volume on disk one on the server and create a shared folder on that volume. You want to enable the volume shadow copy service on the shared folder. What step can you take to accomplish the task? How many of you think it's A? How many of you think it's B? Wow, I give up. You guys, yeah. In the properties for the volume, enable shadow copy for the volume. Very good. Yeah, so basically that's all you're doing is you're creating that volume and enabling the shadow copy as needed. And let's go on to the next section, which is the configuring Hyper-V. This is the third section. And it covers Hyper-V, the basics. I don't want to say the basics, but just the basic concepts around what I need to think about when it comes to Hyper-V. Creating VHCs, removing the VHCs, mounting VHDs, selecting different options around VHDs, and optimizing VHDs. It looks at things like a lot of the concepts that we don't necessarily think about, like NUMA, non-uniform memory access, which I'll talk about in just a second here. But let's first mention just the basic requirements. If you're going to do some level of virtualization, if I'm going to have Hyper-V servers, I have some prerequisites, right? I have to make sure I'm running a system, which most systems are probably running today, that have Intel VT or AMD V technologies, basically that enables it to run with Hyper-V. And the system BIOS itself has to support hardware virtualization as well, and you have to have hardware enforced DEP available on the system. So these are just the basic requirements. You know, if you're in the exam and you're being asked questions, why can't this user run Hyper-V? This may be an option you want to think about. These are things that you want to make sure. If you have a role where you're doing troubleshooting, this is probably some of the first steps you walk through your user to say, okay, I think there's a problem because you don't have hardware DEP installed, right? So think about what the requirements are, know what they are as you're preparing for the exam, and I'll take a pause here and say, virtual labs, how many people use the Microsoft Virtual Labs? If you want to save time in a lot of this stuff, outside of going upstairs, take advantage of the virtual labs. You have, I would say, probably 120 minutes. I don't care what server you go on. Just log on to one of those server 2012 R2. Work with it. See the GUI. Make sure you understand what's going on in the system. It'll save you time from having to think about how do I install it in my system. And you get to learn what the GUI looks like. Again, just do a Bing for Microsoft Virtual Labs. The reason why I'm saying this is if you look at this, right, it talks about what you need to know pretty much for the exam when you're dealing with Hyper-V, the types of questions they're going to want to know. In other words, how do I ensure that I have dynamic memory enabled, the minimum versus maximum RAM, what's the startup RAM, just the idea that you're going to actually configure it to do certain things. The memory buffer, how much memory do I have to allocate to that specific VM to ensure that it's getting what it needs, regardless of what else is running on the system. Knowing the difference between SCSI and IDE, and the fact that SCSI is pretty much what we're starting to see now on the newer server 2012, IDE is kind of going away, you're not seeing that any longer, and the ability to add additional disk as needed, and not have to worry about just having that disk available and then mounting that disk and being able to move forward. And little things that come up as well, things to think about, and you can write this down, and I won't go too much into detail. Things like NUMA. Anybody know what NUMA is? Non-uniform memory access, good. Things like resource metering, managing, if you work in an organization where you have to manage the amount of data that's flowing through a specific set of disks, you want to make sure you know what they are. Little things like virtual machine chimney, in other words, offloading data to the VM host to ensure that you have the maximum output of the VHDs itself, or single root I/O virtualization. These are all technologies that you'll see. And with 7410, it doesn't test you on how you configure those things or why they even exist on the actual VMs or VHD infrastructures. What they really test you on is, do you know whether or not you should use it or not, right? So you might have all those options as a possible question, but think about what they're asking you to do. What is it that you're looking to actually accomplish? And typically, it's literally thinking about what feature am I enabling? What am I looking to do? Am I managing the memory on that system? And that's how you come up with the answers. Last piece with the R2, newer features. You can actually have the integration features enabled so that you can actually use some level of remote management on your VMs on the local machine. It integrates features such as operating system shutdown. If your system shuts down, it shuts down at the same time. Time synchronization, data exchange, and heartbeat. So all those are options that show up now that make it a little bit easier to manage it. And then guest OS, basically managing it as a guest OS as well. So keep that in mind. I won't have time to go through that based on feedback that I've gotten before. Key tips to remember again, this is around Hyper-V and virtual machines. The Windows Server 2012 R2 version of Hyper-V contains massive improvements in the scalability of the systems over previous versions. So the host system can have up to 320 logical processors supporting up to 2,048 virtual CPUs and up to 4 terabytes, as we mentioned earlier. Now, one server can host as many as 1,024 active VMs, and a single VM can have up to 64 virtual CPUs and up to 1 terabyte of memory. So Hyper-V can essentially support up to 64 nodes and 8,000 VMs. So key things to keep in mind, and the PowerShell support is pretty much a huge improvement in Server 2012. Quick question in the back. No, so the question that was asked is on 4.10, it asks you to know different features like SRIOV or some of the integration features, and you were wanting to know to what level you need to know it. This is 7410. Just know what it means. Okay? I'll make it easy for you. Just know what it means. When you get to 4.11 or 4.12, they're going to test you on, possibly how you actually configure it. What about? And same thing with 7417. Just know what it means, okay? It's kind of hard to say for that one because it's a combination of 412 and 413. If you're a previous administrator, you probably need to know a little bit more than just what it means. but good point to bring up. Then it's a typo then. Yeah, you said one of the slides had 63 instead of 64. Yeah, okay, you guys are paying way too much attention. Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay, let's keep going for time's sake here. Server runs Windows Server 2012 with Hyper-V role installed. A virtual machine VM named VM1 runs on the Hyper-V server. VM1 is configured to use dynamic memory. You need to change memory allocation settings for VM1. Which memory allocation setting cannot be changed while VM1 is running? How many think it's A? How many think it's B? And lastly, many people think it's C. And the people that raised their hand in C is actually correct. Awesome. Great job. Yes, sorry, startup RAM. You can't change that. You can't change that while the VM's running. It basically grays it out for you. And the only way to change is to shut that machine down and go back and change that startup RAM. It controls how much RAM the system actually comes up with. A lot of your VMs, when you first set them up, you're going to set them up to have a specific set of startup RAM so you can manage it efficiently if you have to boot up a number of systems at the same time. Okay, moving forward, we're into deploying, configuring core network services. So this covers IPv4, IPv6, DNS, DHCP, and deploying and configuring DNS servers. All of the pieces that come into just the additional management and installation requirements around making sure these work. Again, in 7411 and 7412, you'll see these same concepts. However, they go into much more detail around how you configure it. This just talks about why you would set, you know, things, what you would set up and what it looks like when you have it set up. That's the key here in 7410. Okay? First section, configuring IPv4 and IPv6 addresses. Still very important. So we talk about understanding IPv4 subnetting and supernetting. Because the subnet mask associated with the IP address can vary, the number of bits used to identify the network and the host also can vary. So we call that the CIDR, so classless internet domain routing. You can actually decide what those look like, and we know some of those. Again, for many of you that have the NT exams, these were the core of those exams. You lived through what it was required to make sure you understood subnetting. So I'm going to say it again. Make sure you have a good understanding of how subnetting works. In other words, what do I need to make sure? What do I need to do when I'm configuring it? And another piece that we start seeing quite a bit now is the conversation around IPv6. IPv6 as it pertains to what's on my local machine. And for example, being able to set a global unique address, basically it's routable worldwide and unique to the internet. And because there's so many available, I can't remember the number. It's just absolutely insane the number of addresses that are available, which it won't be a problem, you know, in the long run because of the number of space, the possible combinations of IP addresses, and also knowing what link local unicast addresses are. It's basically auto-assigned in the system. Every card has that link local address. It allows it to talk to another address as needed on the local machine or on the local network. Very similar to automatic IP addressing, a PIPA, if you guys remember that term. This is the similar term. So if you actually did a start run, again, on your local machines, if you're running Windows 7 or Windows 8, do a start run and you have IPv6 enabled, you'll see that there's a link local address. And they all have a special way of annotating the characters where you have FE, FD, FD00, and a way to calculate it, because now you're going to 128 different characters as opposed to the 32-bit characters that you have at 16 with the IPv6 that we typically see now. So, again, the exam tests you on the concepts. I would suggest, again, pulling up an exam book, kind of going through it. Again, and I'll warn you on this, I can spend, you know, an hour and 15 minutes going through the whole session, but you really have to get back and open up that book and look at it. It really is that important. My role, my job here is to just expose you to the importance of each one of these sections, why they matter. And, you know, when they start testing you, it's really your job to make sure that you have taken that concept and internalized it and made it yours. If there are sections in this exam that you already know, put it aside for now and focus on the ones that you don't know, right? Tunneling. So tunneling technologies. Understand when and how those tunneling technologies come into play. For example, the 64 tunneling technology where you're actually encapsulating IPv4 traffic and IPv6 traffic and encapsulating it to send it across the network and have it delivered to the endpoint so that it can be, you know, it can be tunneled and made available. ISOTAP, again, internally, where you can tunnel that, you know, have that traffic tunneled and have data converted from IPv6 data and delivered to an IPv4 system. Teredo, which has the same thing, but it goes over the internet as well. Again, all these terms are just, you know, you might end up with one of those questions that have, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different ones of these listed, and you have to be able to select which one makes the most sense. And understanding which one actually would be the one you'd select. I have a quick image of what that looks like. Kind of get a chance to look at it, understand it, study it, make sure you understand what options are available when you're dealing with that. Deploying and configuring DHCP servers. Now, I purposely did this because I could sit here and talk to you about dynamic host configuration protocols, but what I want to show you is the images matter, right? Each one of these images tell you that the system is in a certain state. So as you're taking the exam, think about what state that system is and what I need to do in terms of, you know, clicking and making a difference. If they come up with a question that says DHCP server is connected but not authorized in Active Directory, I need to right click and authorize it to get it going again. So, you know, nothing crazy, nothing, you know, absolutely insane, but just another way to think about what I need to do with my systems as well. DNS doesn't go away. DNS gets fun. It gets, you know, absolutely interesting because there's still things that you need to know about DNS as you're going through this exam. Just one second. So know the difference between primary and secondary zones. Know the difference between Active Directory and integrated zones when you would actually use it. And some of the commands itself. We talk about the different partitions that are available. So quick question, and we have it here. What is a domain partition, forest DNS zone, and a domain DNS zone? Oh, it's already given you the answer. It's right there. Anybody know? So replication scopes. So they're basically partitions on DNS, right? So it pretty much gives you the answer. These are different partitions, and another piece is to understand the different records and understanding, you know, the difference between start of a record, start of authority records, name servers, you know, A records, C name records, which are, you know, canonical names. And a PTR records, a pointer records, the server records, SRV records, basically help you manage the server record, the service record, and the MX, which is the mail or the exchange record, basically managing mail. So a lot of these terms are still going to come up. Make sure you understand when and how to use them, and also dealing with forward and reverse lookup zones. Key terms to keep in mind: understand the importance of root hints. Understanding, know your subnetting, like I mentioned before, IPv6 global unique addresses versus local addresses, all the way down to being able to distinguish between stub zones, forward zones, and reverse lookup zones. Okay, somebody have a question? Oh, yeah, I'll talk to you later too. All right, see you later. Had me confused for a second. I was like, what? All right, let's ask the question. Server 1 runs server 2012 with the DNS server role installed. Server 1 is joined to the Active Directory domain. Users that have computers joined to the same domain are reporting that they are not able to resolve any server names. After the trouble, should I just stop? Do you guys know the answer? Let's see. Who knows what the answer is? Just shout it out. I'll read the, it sounds like I have to read the rest of it. After troubleshooting the issue, you find that the DNS IP address configured on the client is different from the IP address of server one. You need to prevent the issue in the future. What should you do? How many think it's A? There you go. How many think it's B? And how many people think it's C? All right, so it is actually C. So you're going to configure the static IP address for client computers. Everybody understand why? So which one do you think it is? After troubleshooting the issue, you find that the DNS IP address configured on the client is different from the IP address of the server. You need to prevent the issue in the future, so you configure a static IP address.
Without saying the DNS server
is configured for the issue. Exactly. So,
but it's just not, it just doesn't say that.
Now, to be fair, this is measure up. This is not your exam. So, so you're okay for now, but at least you covered it up. Again, this doesn't test, you know, what you would actually do in a real troubleshooting scenario. It tests a practical scenario on where you have to make a decision. Actually, they're getting better with that, too. You're starting to see a little bit more of the actual real-life scenarios where you have to deal with the question. Okay, last two sections, and we'll finish off here. I'm running out of time. This section covers administering Active Directory. Again, nothing hugely new. The biggest difference that you start seeing is the PowerShell. The PowerShell commands that are built in. Understanding when you would use different PowerShell commands. Still, know your FSMA roles. A lot of the questions you saw with NT and with 2008 were around, what do I install where? Where do I have my infrastructure master? Where do I have my RID master? Where's my global catalog server? What roles can I install with which other servers? And a lot of times I see people get confused with ADDS, Active Directory Domain Services, with ADLDS, Lightweight Directory Services. The two are different. One actually works within a DMZ environment and manages a lightweight copy of the directory services, and the fact that you can actually install from media. One thing to keep in mind with the exam is the DC promo program, again, is deprecated. You won't necessarily use that to install the image itself. Again, it's still a relevant option, but I would probably think twice about selecting that as an option. Always think about using Server Manager and install features to actually install the roles or the domain. And the option is to also think about installing from media if you have to install the multiple machines. DC cloning is still relevant. You can actually still do DC cloning, and you can do it through some level of where it basically strips out the information and makes it basically a unique system, and you can actually install in a different system as well. I put just a few copies of the actual get help commands for managing AD servers, ADDS domain installation. All that can be run through PowerShell. Okay? And managing, create and manage users through ADA, through ADA, Active Directory users of computers. Again, I mentioned this before, you want to automate. You're going to get questions around automation. You're going to get questions around the Active Directory Administrative Center, the ADAC, which is different from the ADOC. You can do a little bit more management through that. You have things like you can manage with the password settings objects. And you can see here, with the newer features, you start thinking about recycle bin and the fine-grained password management. A lot of that you can see with ADAC. You know, ADUC stands for Active Directory Users and Computers, right? That's the old terminology. yes, two newer features. So that's why I said newer features, right? It's, you know, definitely an option there. Managing AD users and groups. So just, again, think about the difference between security and user groups and how you manage users. So the main IDLGP, Identities, Global Group, Domain, Local Access. Basically, being able to manage groups and be able to put them in the right locations where you take a domain group and you add them to a global group
and then the global group gets added to the local group. Things of that nature. Understanding what that looks like. The fact that you can still do group nesting. The fact that you can still control group policies through the ADAC as well. And why you would actually use OUs for decentralized administration. You get those questions around the New York sales office, a different OU than the HR office, and then you start talking about the different Active Directory options. Those are the long questions. You get a huge long question. You just read them through, kind of like you guys did with this last one. Make sure you understand what's being asked. And again, this is what the ADAC looks like. Let's run through one more question here. Currently, all domain controllers run Server 2008 R2. You install a Windows Server 2012 server. You need to promote the Server 2012 server to a domain controller. You need to use the install for media option. What should you do? A, create a system state backup from any Server 2008 R2. B, raise your hand if you think this is right, upgrade one of the existing Server 2008 R2 domain controllers to Server 2012 first, and then create an install for media backup. C, create a FIM, an IFM backup from any existing 2008 R2 backup. So which one do you think it is? Yeah. So I heard some people say D, but there's not even a D on this one. I mean, seriously. Dude, check. When you go in the exam room, just double check, man. Just no, good guess, though. That's a really good guess. Let's keep going here. Create and manage group policies. 15-20% of the exam. Again, last piece. And I'll go through this really quickly. Make sure you do your evaluations. You guys are walking out. I see you. I can actually see you. So this covers link policies, auditing policies, rules and enforcements. It also goes into app restrictions and also firewall rules. Again, that's only 15-20% of that exam. If we have 100% of this, that's probably, I would probably guess around 10 to 12 questions around this. And again, these are crucial questions to make sure you understand what's being asked with each one of these. Understand what group policy is. In other words, you know, when you'd actually use it to deploy software, you know, manage registry settings, manage and configure security settings on the local machine. Understand the difference between local policies and domain policies, and understand the types of policies you have in an infrastructure. You have two default policies, the default domain policies, and the actual domain controller policies. Know which one you're editing and why you're editing which one, each of them. Lastly, know that you can actually link to sites, domains, no use. You can't link to users, groups, or computers, right? You're going to actually manage not the user groups or computers object, but the actual containers that the user groups or computers are contained in. Also, know how you're applying the policies using the computers or the users configuration, and when to use one versus the other. I know many of you probably have a different number of policies within your infrastructure. Last piece here is just again, knowing the difference between local policies, non-local policies, and a newer concept called starter GPOs, where you actually have GPOs that allow you to start up with a framework of what you want as your policy, and then use that later on to do what you want to do. And then the last piece here, we get into the applications and the application restrictions. What can I do with my applications? So this starts off with talking about application restriction policies, just basically software application restrictions. And then in 7411 and 7412, you'll start seeing it goes into AppLocker and a little bit of BitLocker. But this is the initial conversation around what those tools can do. You have the ability to publish to users, assign to users, or assign to computers. And knowing the difference between what you can do with those three, what the users can do. If you assign it to a user computer, it's going to be installed. If you publish it, they have access to actually do what they need to it and install it in their local machine. Understand with AppLocker and group policy, you can actually, you know, request software removals, and the fact that you can manage software restrictions based on policies. Certain type of applications can't be installed, or you can be blocked using a specific hash or anything of that nature. Again, AppLocker becomes relevant, and you can use that starting with Win 7 in 2008 R2. Key tips to know for this section. Remote GP update, it's possible now. You can manage group policy updates across the network and not have to worry about
dealing with it. So again, you'll be tested on some of these new concepts. The GP infrastructure status, being able to know what your group policy infrastructure status looks like. You'll be asked to understand that. Another key thing to remember is Windows RT group policy support. So on the Windows RT system, you can now have group policies applied to it. You can actually use group policies for it. And then lastly, as I mentioned, starter GPOs. Again, another key feature. Think about when you need system starter GPOs, and how you'd actually configure it to do what you need it to do. Last question of the day. You are the system administrator for a medium-sized Active Directory domain. Currently, the environment supports many different domain controllers, some of which are running Windows 2003 and Server 2012. When you are running domain controllers in this type of environment, which of the following types of groups can't you use? How many think it's A? How many think it's B? Oh, shoot. I just clicked the button. Darn. That was an accident. I got all excited. I'm like, hey, that's it. Yeah, so none. You can use all the groups. So there you go. Gave it. It won't happen in the exam. You'll actually click the question. So again, just a quick review, guys. I'm glad you guys stayed a little bit longer. The goal was to make sure you guys understood a little bit of the concepts that you don't know. Make sure you've written it down as you prepare to take the exam. Here are a number of the other sessions that we're covering. As I mentioned, another session that I'll cover is the 7415 and 7416 exam. It's actually not listed on here, but it's tomorrow at 1:30. It's if you're doing desktop and client management. And then resources, you know. Guys, again, thanks for coming today. Don't forget to do your evals. And if you have any questions, let me know. And enjoy Tech Ed.